Sponsorship of the KQED live audio stream comes from Stanford Continuing Studies. This winter, join Stanford historians James Sheehan and David Kennedy for the Cold War and its legacies, exploring the global impact of this pivotal era. Learn more at continuingstudies.stanford.edu.
In history, there was no affordability. Nobody could afford anything.
At the end of a busy week in politics, our correspondents take stock of developments in redistricting, national security, and elections.
It is Friday, December 5th, and this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Juana Summers.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Ahead this hour, a look at the career of the admiral who oversaw strikes on alleged Venezuelan drug boats in the Caribbean.
I will provide the Secretary of Defense and the President candid and clear military advice, and I will remain fully transparent with this committee.
Also, if it feels like traffic keeps getting worse, that's probably because it is.
Yeah, researchers say congestion is now back to pre-pandemic levels in most of the United States.
There are so many people in San Diego that there is always traffic. Always.
And the 2026 World Cup is taking shape. We will tell you how after the news.
Live from KQED News, I'm Natalia Navarro. New legislation unveiled in San Francisco this morning would provide over $5 billion in new federal funding for affordable housing and efforts to combat homelessness. California Senator Adam Schiff announced the bill on the roof of a brand new affordable housing project in the Dog Patch neighborhood alongside city officials. Here's Schiff.
We need to be building a lot more housing all throughout California. Housing that is affordable, housing that meets the needs of families, working families, middle-income housing, low-income housing. We need it all.
The bill, known as the Housing Boom Act, is part of a joint push by House and Senate Democrats to emphasize affordability. San Francisco's school district says it expects to exit state fiscal oversight this year, but it will need to make steep budget cuts first. KQED's Katie DiBenedetti reports.
The district slashed more than $100 million from its budget last year, eliminating hundreds of positions to move out of the state's worst financial status. Now, Superintendent Maria Sue says another $100 million in cuts will stabilize spending.
We are moving closer to fully restoring local control over our budget and exiting state oversight. However, we are still struggling in really tough times. We still need to make additional reductions.
Progress could be jeopardized, though, by an escalating strike threat from teachers. Current spending projections don't include their union's contract demands. I'm Katie DiBenedetti, KQED News.
UC Berkeley is launching a first-of-its-kind initiative today to close the gap in medical research between male and female athletes. The Women's Health and Performance Initiative will use AI and data from UC Berkeley athletes to build health models specifically for women. Former UC President Janet Napolitano is leading the project. She says using male data for female bodies creates risks, not just on the field, but in national defense.
So as we improve health outcomes through this initiative for female athletes, we can apply lessons learned or new technology created or new tools developed to the health outcomes of women who have chosen to protect the nation.
Napolitano says less than 10% of sports medicine research now is focused exclusively on women. Bay Area soccer fans gathered at Chase Center in San Francisco this morning to find out what teams will play each other in the 2026 FIFA World Cup. The U.S. will play in Group D with Paraguay and Australia, and a fourth team that will be determined by playoffs in March. Levi's Stadium in Santa Clara will host five of these group games. The FIFA schedule shows groups D and J assigned to that location and could include teams from Algeria, Austria, Jordan, and Argentina. San Jose native and FIFA World Cup champion Brandi Chastain says holding the World Cup in the Bay Area could change people's lives.
It will give opportunity. It will show soccer at the highest level. It will allow for one young kid, hopefully if not hundreds of thousands of them, to see themselves in the game.
Levi's Stadium will also host one other game later in the tournament. Tosh Lapoy says his number one priority as UC Berkeley's new head football coach isn't on the field. Lapoy was appointed yesterday to replace Justin Wilcox, who was fired just a day after Cal's team lost to its rival, Stanford Cardinal. Lapoy, a Cal football alum and former defensive line coach, appeared at a press conference today to share his vision for the team's future.
The first thing is talent acquisition. That is extremely, extremely important for us of how we recruit, the coaching staff that we bring in here, and then from there, developing and implementing our culture.
Lapoy says he plans to engage directly with potential recruits and highlight the value of a Berkeley degree and a robust football program. More news online at kqed.org. I'm Natalia Navarro.
Support comes from European Sleepworks in Berkeley, where research-driven design helps yield sustainable mattress comfort. Learn more at sleepworks.com. Support for NPR comes from the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping those in need is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at lodestarfoundation.org and from the listeners of KQED. And support for KQED comes from Cal Privacy, enforcing privacy regulations and protecting consumer rights. Californians can take control of their personal information by opting out of selling and sharing it with businesses. More information at privacy.ca.gov.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. It was another busy week in politics. The Supreme Court approved controversial redistricting plans in Texas. Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth was in hot water, in part because of strikes on alleged Venezuelan drug boats in the Caribbean. Oh, and also there was another special election. So we've asked senior White House correspondent Tamara Keefe and senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro to join us today to take a step back and put all of this into context. Hi to both of you.
Hello.
Hey.
Tam, I want to start with you and Secretary Hegseth, who was at the center of some really big scrutiny this week. Tell us what happened.
It all comes back to Hegseth's leadership and judgment as Secretary of Defense. He was clearly in the hot seat all week. There was concern about the boat strike on September 2nd, where there were survivors who were then hit a second time and killed. Top lawmakers on key committees went into a closed-door hearing this week with bipartisan concerns. During that meeting, they saw a full video of the strikes, and they came out divided over how alarmed people should be about what happened. And they were divided on partisan political lines. And that briefing up on the Hill happened on the same day that an independent inspector general at the Department of Defense released a report that found back in March, Hegseth had violated policy and risked the safety of U.S. service members by sharing sensitive military information in a group chat.
Yeah, and politically, I mean, we've seen Republicans come to Hegseth's defense clearly here. You know, they're pointing to former President Barack Obama for these double-tap drone missile firings in the war on terrorism that were really controversial. They're saying that he wrote the playbook on this. The Pentagon spokesman called the Inspector General's report a, quote, total exoneration, but that's not quite true. And, you know, it's just another example in the Trump era of just saying something is true and then hoping the base will echo those talking points. And that's also been the case with Trump's recent racist comments about Somalis and Afghan refugees. You know, it's part of the Trump playbook to distract from worse news, like negative views of his handling of the economy, frankly, and go to xenophobia, immigration, and other culture war issues. And his base has generally gone right along with that.
Mm-hmm. And Hegseth is one part of all of this, but what are we learning this week about the way that the Trump administration is approaching foreign policy and national defense?
Well, the White House put out a 33-page national security strategy document for the country. It's pretty notable for how Trump and his administration see the United States' role in the world. A few things really jumped out to me. One, there's real isolationist tendencies in it, noting, for example, quote, the affairs of other countries are our concern only if their activities directly threaten our interests. Second, there's a clear retrenchment and focus on the Western Hemisphere, which we've seen already here. And thirdly, there's this very harsh negative view of Europe. The document describes Europe as undergoing economic decline and, quote, civilizational erasure tied to migration.
But I have to say, this is not entirely surprising given what we've already seen and know about President Trump.
Yeah, it's in line with how he has governed. But the document does lay this out explicitly, and it is quite the crack up of the post-World War II order of alliances that largely kept peace and security for the West for well more than half a century at this point. And the question I have with this document is, will this be an enduring position, or will it shift depending on who the president's talking to, as policies often do under this president?
But at the same time, Republicans are grappling with a whole lot of data that suggests that voters are souring on Trump. Tell us what we're seeing.
Well, Trump is really at his lowest point in his presidency politically. His approval ratings are the lowest he's seen, averaging now in the high 30s. He's in the 20s in our polling with independents, and so much of that is about the economy. His handling of it is low, as the cost of living has really been the dominant issue on people's minds. And yet, Trump again this week was dismissing affordability as something important.
You know, there's this fake narrative that the Democrats talk about, affordability. They just say the word. It doesn't mean anything to anybody. They just say it. Affordability. I inherited the worst inflation in history. There was no affordability. Nobody could afford anything.
You know, it certainly was the key issue in the special election we just saw this week in Tennessee, where Democrats again overperformed. The Republican won there, but Democrats did better. So clearly the cost of living does really matter to people.
What has the White House been saying about all of this?
Well, first, they insist that they do not have their hair on fire about mm-hmm. what happened in Tennessee. I did go in and speak with a senior White House official earlier this week who said that the president's travel is really going to ramp up at the end of this year. The first stop, the only one that's been announced so far, is next Tuesday in Pennsylvania. The focus will be affordability. But I have to say, this same senior White House official told me almost exactly the same thing almost a month ago. That time, I was told that the message would be about empathy on mm-hmm. crisis. He's saying, you know, I feel your pain. We've done a lot, but there's a lot more we need to do. But as we've seen, the president keeps steering back to the idea of affordability as a word that Democrats made up as some kind of con job against him. That lack of message discipline has been hard to break. And the problem with the cost of living is people go to the grocery store all the time. They are out Christmas shopping, holiday shopping right now. And they can see for themselves what things cost.
Right. And we've also talked a whole lot about the structural advantages that Republicans have when it comes to the midterms next year. Where do things stand now?
Well, the Supreme Court last night delivered a big victory to Republicans, saying that the maps drawn in Texas can stand. That mid-decade redrawing of lines was designed to give Republicans up to 5 more seats in an already heavily Republican state. President Trump has been a driving force behind that, because he is very openly concerned about what happens if Republicans lose control of the House.
And still, though, for Republicans, you know, they're trying to gain more seats, and they very well may create more in some place like Texas, but they may not get as many as they would have hoped for, and they're being offset by places like California and elsewhere. And in a wave year, redrawing those seats and making some of them less Republican could backfire. And it's part of a reason, that and affordability, why we've seen potentially so many Republicans retiring from Congress, a real sign that Republicans are taking it very seriously, that this could be a wave year coming up for Democrats next year.
Because nobody likes to be in the minority.
NPR's Tamara Keith and Domenico Montanaro, thanks to both of you.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
If it seems like traffic is getting worse where you live, that is probably because it is. Researchers say congestion has bounced all the way back to pre-pandemic levels in most of the U.S., in fact, to the highest levels on record. And the conventional wisdom about the worst days, worst times to drive, that's changing too, as NPR's Joel Rose reports.
A few weeks ago, Taylor Vecchione vented her growing frustration with traffic in San Diego.
Do you remember when traffic started at, like, 5?
In this video posted on TikTok, Vecchione filmed herself sitting in her car, lamenting how things in her Southern California hometown have changed.
Now, there are so many people in San Diego that there is always traffic. Always.
Turns out there is actual data to back her up on this. San Diego has seen a significant jump in traffic delays, according to researchers, as congestion nationwide equaled and in many places surpassed pre-pandemic levels in 2024.
We are back, but the delay kind of has a different feel to it than it did before.
David Schrank is a senior research scientist at the Texas A&M Transportation Institute, which has tracked congestion since the 1980s in its annual Urban Mobility Report. For decades, Schrank says those patterns barely changed until now. The rush hour peaks are still the worst times to drive. But he says there's more congestion at other times, too.
It's spread out over more of the day, and thus it's not just a commuter issue as much as it's a, you know, everyone is experiencing more of that delay.
Those aren't the only changes researchers are seeing. Schrank says trucks are causing more congestion, and there's more delay on weekends, while traffic on Mondays tends to be noticeably lighter than the other weekdays.
There's more variability day to day than there was pre-pandemic. The day of the week matters and the time of the day matters.
Schrank and his colleagues ranked every metropolitan area in the U.S. by hours of traffic delay in 2024. San Diego saw the biggest percentage jump in hours of delay per commuter, although it still ranks below the San Francisco Bay Area and Los Angeles, which topped the list. Michael Manville is a professor of urban planning at UCLA. He cautions against reading too much into individual city rankings, but he says the overall findings make sense.
Congestion moves largely in sync with broader patterns in regional economies, and so if you have the economy doing well, congestion tends to be worse. If you have a recession, it tends to be a little bit better.
Researchers also identified a few regions where congestion is down compared to before the pandemic, including Washington, D.C. That could be linked to the persistence of remote work in the federal government in 2024. And it may also have something to do with regional efforts to fight congestion, including a tolling strategy known as dynamic pricing.
If you're going to contribute to the excessive congestion during the peak and the evening rush hours, perhaps, you'll be paying more for the toll.
Robert Puentes is a transportation expert at the Brookings Institution. He lives in Northern Virginia, which has adopted an extensive system of tolls on major highways that charge different prices at different times. Puentes says that seems to be helping reduce congestion.
It's something that really could be applicable in other metropolitan areas. We see places in Texas and California and other places that are using it. I think it has a real future in this country.
Another ambitious effort to fight congestion is happening in New York City, where car drivers now pay as much as $9 to enter Lower Manhattan. That congestion pricing plan has already cut traffic in the toll zone since its launch in January, but it's still too early to say how much it's changing commuting patterns across the region. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Your Bay Area traffic update at 6:18 starts with a stall in San Leandro. Here's Steve Herrera.
Hi, Michelle. Your drive is moving at a snail's pace in San Leandro. Southbound Nimitz, just before Marina Boulevard, a car broke down in the right lane. Trouble on the Dumbarton, eastbound 84 at the high rise, a three-car fender bender blocking the right lane. And it's a big bottleneck driving into San Francisco on the Bay Bridge. You're stopped from Grand Avenue to the metering lights and more slowing to 101. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Support for KQED comes from East Bay SPCA, proud to connect Bay Area pets and people so they can share the love this holiday season and help save lives. For more information, visit eastbayspca.org. And from Berkeley Rep, presenting Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol, a ghost story told by Jefferson Mays, a special one-week engagement through December 21st. More info at berkeleyrep.org. Admiral Frank Mitchell Bradley is in the spotlight for overseeing controversial boat strikes. Stay tuned for a profile of Bradley in the final segment of today's All Things Considered.
On the next California Report magazine, rescued audio recordings from a queer church in San Francisco that provided a refuge during the height of the AIDS crisis.
Each one is of infinite worth, whether that person is diseased or not. We have AIDS as a community, and God loves us.
I'm Sasha Coca. Join us later today on KQED or the California Report Magazine podcast.
The California Report comes on this evening at 6:30.
On the next Fresh Air, we remember Steve Cropper, house guitarist at the Memphis label Stax Records, and listen back to our 1990 interview. He died this week at the age of 84. Stax created some of the most important Southern soul music of the 1960s, with recordings by Booker T and the MGs, Otis Redding, Wilson Pickett, Isaac Hayes, and others. Join us.
Stay tuned for Fresh Air tonight at 7. Support for NPR comes from Sony Pictures Classics, presenting Merrily We Roll Along, a new cinematic interpretation of the Stephen Sondheim musical, starring Jonathan Groff, Daniel Radcliffe, and Lindsay Mendez, now playing in movie theaters. Your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the listeners of KQED-FM San Francisco and KQEI-FM North Highlands.
This is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Juana Summers. As any of our regular listeners know, the late Susan Stamberg, NPR's special correspondent, spent many years reporting on cultural giants, including the man who helped transform contemporary architecture, Frank Gehry. Gehry died on Friday at 96 years old. Mrs. Stamberg prepared this reflection on Gehry's career.
Swoopy, swirling, gleaming, sculpted, Frank Gehry made buildings we had never seen before. He won all the top awards, the Pritzker Prize, presidential medals. When the American Institute of Architects gave him their gold medal in 1999, Gehry looked out at an audience that included contemporary gods of building, and he said, "It's like finding out my big brothers love me after all."
He was probably the only truly great artist I've ever encountered who desperately cared what people thought of him and that people loved his work.
Gehry's biographer Paul Goldberger says the architect got his share of criticism.
Accusations that he made crazy shapes and paid no attention to budget.
But the praise was louder because his striking buildings made people happy.
Well, I've always been for optimism and architecture not being sad.
This is Gehry on NPR in 2004.
You know, a building for music and performance should be joyful.
There was exuberance in his work. The swoops and swirls, made possible with aerospace technology, lifted the spirits of viewers used to post-war modernism, strict, boxy glass and steel buildings, imposing but unwelcoming.
Very cold and inhuman and lifeless. I thought it was possible to find a way to express feeling and humanistic qualities in a building. But I wasn't clear about it until I started experimenting quite accidentally with fish forms.
He loved their motion, their shape. He drew them all his life, an inspiration that began in his grandmother's bathtub in Toronto.
Every Thursday when I stayed at her house, I'd go with her to the market and there would be a big bag of some kind filled with water that we would carry home with a big carp in it. We'd put it in the bathtub. I would sit and watch it, and then the next day it was gone.
Made into gefilte fish, a classic dish of Jewish cookery. That carp swam in Gehry's memory long past supper time. He translated their curves and motions into architecture. In Prague, Czechs call his design for an office building Fred and Ginger. Two cylindrical towers, one solid, the other glass, pinched in at the waist, elegant like dancers, Astaire and Rogers. His Disney Hall and his Guggenheim Museum swell like symphonies.
He really wanted you to feel a sense of movement. You know, a building is a static thing, but if it feels like it's moving, for him that was more exciting.
The Guggenheim in Bilbao, Spain, a billowing swirl of titanium in gold and sunset colors, excited viewers. After it opened in 1997, Gehry said everyone who came to him wanted a Bilbao. Paul Goldberger says Gehry wasn't interested.
Like all great artists, he wanted to keep pushing himself and move forward. He did not want to copy himself. He did not want to do that building again.
Bilbao and Disney Hall in Los Angeles. It opened in 2003, a swoosh of silver stainless steel, 1/16th of an inch thick. Those are Gehry's signature buildings, but they're a far cry from his early work. His own 1978 residence in Santa Monica sports common materials. If clients couldn't afford fancy, marble, say, he would use cheap.
And so he started using plywood and chain-link fence and corrugated metal.
Those buildings got attention, but the later ones made him a star, and a term was coined, Starkitect. Biographer Paul Goldberger says Gehry hated it.
But in fact, he didn't really hate fame.
In fact, he liked it.
But he was too smart to sacrifice everything for it.
Gehry kept to his vision, turned down jobs that didn't feel right, imagined others that got built were widely admired, but sometimes didn't live up to his imagination.
You know, what's in my mind's eye is always 10 times better than what I ever achieve, because the dream image can leak.
Bill Clinton gave him the National Medal of Arts. Barack Obama gave him the Presidential Medal of Freedom. The New Yorker called Bilbao a masterpiece of the 20th century. Architect Philip Johnson said it was the building of the century. And the public, with some exceptions, of course, adored the work. Gehry's legacy?
He made great architecture accessible to people.
It's been said that architecture is the message a civilization sends to the future. With walls that are shaped and sculpted and buildings that look joyous and free, Frank Gehry's is a message of humanism and hope. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News.
Lawmakers are still asking questions about a boat strike in the Caribbean that killed 2 survivors of an initial strike. The Trump administration says the boat was transporting narcotics. That's brought Admiral Frank Mitchell Bradley, the man who oversaw the strikes, into the spotlight. But who is he? NPR's Sage Miller tells us what she's learned.
Since he started his military career in 1992, Bradley has mostly remained outside the public view. That all changed within the last week.
Admiral Bradley.
Admiral Mitch Bradley.
Admiral Bradley.
Admiral Bradley.
That's because the White House says Bradley approved a controversial second strike that killed survivors of an initial attack on board an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean. While Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth says he wasn't in the room during the second strike, he says he thinks Bradley made the correct decision.
He sunk the boat and eliminated the threat. And it was the right call. We have his back.
Here's what we know about Bradley. He currently oversees United States Special Operations Command, or SOCOM. According to his official biography, he graduated from the United States Naval Academy with a degree in physics. After that, Bradley started his career as a Navy SEAL. He was among the first to deploy into Afghanistan following the 9/11 terrorist attacks. He's married and the father of 4 children. During his Senate nomination hearing to lead SOCOM earlier this year, Bradley spoke about his roots.
So I come from a small ranching community in Southwest Texas, where I learned the foundations of meritocracy at an early age. I'm the son of a World War II veteran, Army Air Corps Master Sergeant, who worked on P-38s from Operation Torch in North Africa to the final assault on Berlin.
After the war, Bradley's father served as a Corps official in their Texas community.
I learned a deep appreciation for our democracy and the judicial system, watching him dispense judgment in our community. His example of service and the allure of adventure are what drew me to the United States Naval Academy and the SEAL community.
Speaking at the nomination hearing in July, Bradley also made a promise.
I will provide the Secretary of Defense and the President candid and clear military advice, and I will remain fully transparent with this committee, ensuring that you have the information necessary to continue your critical constitutional oversight of our national defense.
And as congressional leaders probe the Pentagon and Bradley's involvement in the strikes, their hope is he maintains that promise of transparency. Sage Miller, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
Your KQED traffic update at 6:29 starts with a crash in San Mateo. Here's Steve Herrera.
Hi, Michelle. I see heavy traffic on the peninsula. On the northbound Highway 35 transition to westbound 92, a wreck is blocking the connector lane. In Saratoga, southbound 85 after Saratoga Avenue, there's a crash impacting the center divide. And an ongoing SIG alert still in effect for Half Moon Bay. Both directions of Highway 92 shut down between Main Street and Old Kenyatta Road following an overturned crash. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from Stay Healdsburg, home to a holiday collection of festive events and immersive experiences. Learn more at aseasontosparkle.com. And from BART. BART connects riders to holiday events around the bay, ballet, theater, music, and more with easy tap-and-ride payment. More information on seasonal events at bart.gov/bartable. It's 6:30, and this is KQED News.
Support for the California Report comes from the Westley Foundation, investing in California's underserved children and youth. The James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
I'm Sasha Coca, and it's the California Report magazine. Today, we're going back in time to visit a queer church that provided refuge and support to the gay community in San Francisco during the height of the AIDS crisis. December 1st marked World AIDS Day. It's a day dedicated to raising awareness of the pandemic caused by the spread of HIV and mourning loved ones who've died. And while new infections and deaths have decreased, across the globe, AIDS remains a major public health issue. Around 40 million people are living with the disease. But not that long ago, the idea of living with AIDS seemed impossible. Today, we're going to bring you something really special. It's the first episode of a new podcast from Eureka Street Productions called When We All Get to Heaven. It's an immersive listening experience, and it chronicles a time when this one church tried to give people hope as AIDS devastated the gay community in San Francisco back in the late 1980s and early 1990s. The podcast draws on sound from 1,200 cassette tapes rescued from a trash pile, recordings made at the church of songs, memorials, and sermons.
Have you had the experience of not even being able to remember the names of people who were once dear to you? This week I was driving in my truck and I popped in a Madonna tape. And when I did, I had a remembrance of a person who was very dear to me, with whom I saw Truth or Dare 3 times in 1 week. But I could hardly remember him anymore, because there have been so many people that we've lost, that I've lost. I really, for a moment, almost couldn't remember his name. And he really was very dear to me. And I wanted to cry out, I remember you.
That's Jim Matulski. He's a minister. It's 1993, and he's 35 years old. He's already officiated at more funerals than many pastors will ever do in their whole lives.
And there are people here that I want to cry out to the universe. They lived. They were here. We knew them. We loved them. We remember them tonight at this table.
When We All Get to Heaven brings to life voices of loss and of faith, of people who refused to abandon their spirituality or their queerness, and who built a community that could hold both. Here's host Lynn Gerber with the first episode. It's called Setting the Table.
The table sits at the front of a church sanctuary, which looks a little bit like the inside of a barn, with a high ceiling, a small balcony, and rafters painted white. The building itself is wedged between 2 houses on a residential street in a busy San Francisco neighborhood.
And I invite you at this moment to lift up the names of people that perhaps you can barely remember, or people who you remember so well, it hurts to say their names almost. say their names so that they become part of this communion.
It's a Sunday night, and the people there are mostly men. A lot of them are young, and a lot of them are sick. Some may be walking with canes or IV poles. Some may be lying in the laps of their friends, too weak to sit up. If you listen closely, you can hear their coughing. Some walked just a few blocks to be at this healing service. Others drove for miles.
This is a table of remembrance and a table of promise as well, that one day we will be with all the people that we've ever loved together at a heavenly banquet where no one can ever separate us ever again.
People here didn't always necessarily spend a lot of time in churches. Neither did the people they were remembering. They usually weren't welcomed. They were told that their suffering was their own fault, and that by God's logic, it was deserved. They were gay men at the height of the AIDS epidemic, and a month earlier, in January of 1993, San Francisco reached the grim marker of 10,000 dead.
Our healing comes tonight in our remembering and in our claiming that promise of love that is stronger than death and of love that never ends.
The people Jim's talking to are living or trying to live through the overlapping crises that were AIDS in the 1980s and the early 90s. The medical crisis of a novel, brutal, fatal disease with no treatment and no cure. The social crisis, hitting mostly marginalized people, queer folks, drug users, people of color, with everyone else terrified of being next. The political crisis of a government that seemed indifferent to AIDS, contemptuous of people with it, and doing close to nothing to support sick people or the search for treatment, especially in that first terrible decade. So what do you do if you're one of those people facing AIDS? You're up against an existential threat. You need to make meaning of suffering, death, and what comes after, if anything comes after. And you need the support of community. The kind of community that knows how to do stuff, like bring over meals and organize rides to doctor's appointments and tell stories and sing songs that make crises make a little more sense. A community like a church. But many, many churches won't welcome you or the people you love most. They don't recognize you in life and won't remember you in death. And what do you do if you're Jim or one of the other pastors facing this congregation with these tools of Christian faith, knowing full well how that faith can betray queer people? Because as out gay and lesbian ministers, it's betrayed you too. Maybe you make another kind of church, one where the question of homosexuality is settled as a blessing, not a curse, where the queer lost are remembered and queer kin are recognized, where queer lives can be grieved and fought for and remembered and maybe even saved. The recording of folks calling out the names of their dead is from a communion service at the Metropolitan Community Church of San Francisco, or MCC. It's a queer Christian church, and it offered communion two or three times every Sunday through the hardest years of the AIDS crisis. When people were too sick to come to church, the church brought the ritual to their homes and their hospital rooms. And starting in 1987, they also brought cassette tapes. The reason we have any story to tell at all is those tapes. In 1987, a guy named Keith was a regular at MCC. He worked in audio and wanted to help folks who were sick and missing out on the spiritual center of the week. This is the tech olden days. If you missed an event, you couldn't watch it on the internet 5 minutes later. Cassette recordings would help people stay part of things. People who were too sick to come to church could get news from the announcements, sing along with the hymns, learn a little something from the sermons. They could stay part of the church's community. So Keith designed a sound room, got professional equipment, pulled together some volunteers, recorded services, and made copies on humble, portable cassette tapes. They made these recordings for years. Then times changed, and technology changed, and these recordings were put away and forgotten. Almost 25 years later, a guy named Steve, another longtime MCC congregant, asked me if I knew about all these tapes he had found. I'm a scholar of American religion and a longtime friend of the church, and I had recently gotten interested in their history. Now, I'm not Christian and I'm not a lesbian, and I told MCC that when I first started hanging out there. And they told me, you know, we have this saying, if you're here, you're queer. So there I was, in the church office, when Steve told me he had picked all these tapes out of a trash pile and stored them under the floor of the sound room. I wasn't sure that I really wanted to know what Steve found while poking through the church's garbage. I imagined a box or two of random wobbly recordings of Christmas services or choir concerts, maybe a sermon or two. But it turns out my imagination was seriously limited, and his trash picking, a revelation. He showed me a collection of 1,200 cassettes, recordings of two services every Sunday for most of the years between 1987 and 2003. I knew what those years were about in San Francisco, and that these tapes had to be a remarkable record of a terrible time. But I didn't know specifics. Then I started listening, and my imagination was utterly taken by the stories these tapes were telling. Stories of people, of relationships, of crises, of fear and fury and faith. I didn't know people laughed that much in church. I didn't know all the different ways they channeled their grief. I didn't know any of the songs. The combination of utter queerness and utter Christianness messed with my head. I listened and I listened, and I've been listening ever since.
Dear God, there were times I hated my life.
From up here, I can see every kind of dyke I've ever heard of and a few new ones. I can see high femmes and stone butches and baby dykes.
San Francisco is as good as it gets.
We of the Metropolitan Community Church refute the claim that any person's sexual orientation needs to be changed.
I don't know whether to laugh or to cry when I think about Randy Nosser, who was losing his vision when I came to see him in the hospital, and I walked in the room and I said, "It's Jim Matulski," and he said, "I know, I recognize the shape."
I do remember one time at dinner, and there was a very handsome male couple sitting at the table next to me, and one of us decided that they were much too attractive to be together, and we went over and told them that they had to break up and go get ugly lovers.
And I told her what safe sex is, and I told her how I aim to survive, and I told her that I didn't come out of the closet not to have sex.
Now, one of his t-shirts, I think it says, I have, is it 4 or 8 T-cells left, and I've named them? And the last one, his last T-cell, is named God.
We are standing on holy ground.
I remember standing with my friend at the corner of Castro and Market, and I remember saying, you know, I wish we could level all these pretty Victorians. And if this was a meadow, and there were 1,000 corpses rotting in the sun, then people would look at it and they would understand what was happening to us here.
I stood down in front of doctors and said, what are we going to do now?
And they looked at me and said, well, we're going to try this. I said, what do you mean we're going to try? You mean you don't know? And he said, no, we don't.
There's a place for us.
We may not be able to cure AIDS right now, but every time a person with AIDS lives one more day, connects with one more person, eats one more meal, sings one more praise, they are participating in healing.
Each one is of infinite worth, whether that person is diseased or not. We have AIDS as a community, and God loves us.
And to the enemies who are attacking us, we say to you, we're not closing up shop. We're just starting a revival here at Eureka Street at Metropolitan Community Church, and we're going to go on. God bless you this morning. Amen.
I first got interested in this church's history because of what MCC called the AIDS years and how the disease had devastated the congregation and the community. I remembered the 80s and how talk of AIDS was saturated with moral and religious condemnation. I could not have imagined a way for Christianity to be redeemed from that, or that queer people would even bother trying. But I started to listen to these tapes, and I was totally riveted.
When we all get to heaven, 174.
Because the congregation's refusal to deny their queerness or their religiousness and the religious things they made out of that very refusal moved me in this way that I couldn't let go of. Take this as an example. On first listen, to a religious outsider like me, this sounds like a kind of Christianity that could give me real pause. The kind of Christianity that sets itself up in opposition to urban coastal dwellers, such as myself, and to queer people everywhere. On a different kind of first listen, a religious insider might hear things I couldn't, like how they changed the words. If you grew up in church singing this song and were humming along, you might have gotten through the Sing the Wondrous Love of Jesus part just fine. But you might have stopped short at Sing God's Mercy and Thy Grace. Because odds are good the words you sang as a kid were Sing His Mercy and His Grace. But MCC is a queer church and a feminist church, and in some ways an Orthodox one. By Orthodox, I mean that they believed certain theological basics of Christian faith that stretch way back into antiquity. And according to those basics, God is beyond all human categories, gender included. MCC knew their theology, and they were serious enough about their own blend of queerness, feminism, and orthodoxy to rewrite all of their beloved hymns to reflect what they truly believed. First listeners across the board may well hear the kind of queer sensibility in the singing that made me unable to turn away. A sensibility that becomes more visceral on the second or third listen, when you realize that this is being sung by a gay church at the height of the AIDS epidemic, and the words start sinking in. When we all get to heaven, heaven is real. We queer folks are going to get there, and some of us with AIDS are going to get there really soon. Some of us are there already. We'll sing and shout the victory. There's something for us to celebrate here. We think we won something, the biggest thing, actually, and we're going to shout about it. And just the sheer audacity of the we, We all. This song is about us, all of us. The promise of this place is for all of us. And we're going to make church as if that might actually be true. We're going to go on faith.
Shoot, you can't feel that, you're dead.
Back in the MCC sanctuary, that Sunday evening in 1993, communion is about to start.
Our healing comes tonight in our remembering and in our claiming that promise of love that is stronger than death and of love that never ends.
Jim picks up a loaf of bread and a chalice and raises them before the congregation.
We remember Jesus taking bread and breaking it and sharing it with his friends and saying, "This is my body." We remember him taking a cup and sharing it with them and saying, "This is my life."
Sharing the bread and the cup is the core of communion, a ritual remembrance of Jesus' last night before his crucifixion. For many Christians, it's the sacred center of their ritual life. The Bible says Jesus asked his friends to eat bread and drink wine to remember him after he was gone. And they did.
We remember the woman who broke open an alabaster jar and about whom Jesus said, "Remember her. She has done a beautiful thing."
The woman with the alabaster jar? She was an outcast, sexually suspect, shamed for this extravagant offering she made to Jesus. But she wasn't shamed by Jesus himself. He's the one who saw the beauty in her gift and said it would be remembered. Few Christians remember her, especially at communion. But that night, MCC did.
And tonight, we remember all the people we love. Let us pray. God, we give you thanks for this bread and this cup, these symbols of remembrance and of promise to us. Nourish us in this meal with food that satisfies.
When We All Get to Heaven is a podcast for all of us, religious or not, queer or not, HIV positive or not, alive in the early AIDS years or not. The people that made these recordings encompass those differences. Those of us making this podcast do too. And we know our listeners will too. Whether you've spent half your life in a church or would never enter a real live one, we invite you to spend some time with this one. Because this is a community that knew how to face loss and make hope in hard times. And that's something all of us are going to need to learn how to do if we're going to get through the existential crises in front of us. We're setting a different kind of table of remembrance with this project. A table set in sounds and stories. In moments captured on tape decades ago, and in conversation we've had with folks about those moments in just the last few years. Different listeners will hear different things in it and will take different things from it. But here, too, all are welcome.
In your many names we pray. Amen.
Before they share communion at MCC San Francisco, before folks are invited to eat a piece of bread and take a sip of juice, they let folks know that the table is open to everyone, that you don't have to believe in Christianity, in God, or in anything at all to be welcome to the table.
Everyone is welcome to come forward tonight to share in this communion. Communion with God, however it is that you understand God. Communion with people past and present and to come. Come forward and receive the bread and cup. Come forward and have someone pray with you for healing of any sort, if you like. This is a time to receive, a time to be open to God's grace. If you wish to receive healing, come here. If you wish to receive communion, go there. If you want to just be in your seat and pray for healing for others, let us create a tabernacle of healing tonight with our prayers and our thoughts.
That was the first episode of a new podcast called When We All Get to Heaven.
As the episodes continue, host Lynn Gerber explores how the church grew from a gathering held by a charismatic gay preacher in his L.A. living room to an established denomination. Here's a sneak preview of episode 2. It's called A New Gospel for Gay Sinners.
Now, I can tell you about that first service. Would you like me to?
I would love that.
Okay.
That's Connie Staff telling me about the first time she visited the Metropolitan Community Church of San Francisco.
That first service was really wonderful. We walked in, we looked around, and we saw men. There were a few women, four maybe. So Diane and I almost walked out because while it was very welcoming, it was a sea of men. That's how I've always described it. It was a sea of men.
Connie and Diane, who was Connie's partner at the time, first went to MCC in 1980. Connie was in her 20s and exploring queer spirituality.
We didn't walk out, though. We sat in the back, and we navigated the service as best we could because it was quite a different service than we'd ever been to.
She had gone to church a lot in her life, but not to a church like this.
When it came time for communion, which in typical fashion for MCCs, people walked up and there were four or five different stations. It was not a situation where you took some bread or a cracker and you dipped it and then a short phrase was said to you and you go back to your seat. No. It was that people were praying with each other up there and touching each other, and we did not have the courage to go up and do that service. But we did watch, and we watched how people were relating. Now, what happened after the service, we tried to duck out, as folks often do. But lo and behold, we hear this voice from down by the church yelling, "Wait! Wait! Don't go yet! Wait!"
This is for all of you Baptists out there who like to have a nice feel-good song.
That episode explores why a queer person, why Connie and others might go to a gay church in the first place, why they might go back, and why they might stay, even or especially in a crisis. When We All Get to Heaven is a project of Eureka Street Productions and is distributed by Slate. You can hear the entire series on Slate's Outward podcast wherever you get your podcasts. It was co-created and produced by Lynn Gerber, Siri Colum, and Ariana Nettleman. Their production team includes Sarah Quevedo, David Herman, Chrissy Clark, Tim Dillinger-Curinton, Betsy Towner-Levine, and Ariana Martinez. The music comes largely from MCC's San Francisco archive and is performed by its members, ministers, and friends. Additional music is by Domestic BGM. That's it for the California Report magazine. Our senior editor is Victoria Maleon. Susie Racho is our director producer. Brendan Willard is our engineer. Srishti Prabha is our intern. And I'm Sasha Coca. You can catch all of our California stories on our podcast, The California Report Magazine. Your state, your stories.
Support for the California Report comes from the Wesley Foundation, investing in California's underserved children and youth. The James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. and Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose philanthropy works to create a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org.
Fresh Air remembers Steve Cropper this evening. The house guitarist at the Memphis label Stax Record died this week at age 84. Fresh Air starts after your traffic update, including a crash in San Jose. Here's Steve Herrera.
Hi, Michelle. It's slow and go in the South Bay, northbound 101. Just before Tully, I'm getting first reports of a multi-vehicle pileup taking away the two right lanes. Heavy in Sunol, southbound 680 after 84 West, a multi-vehicle crash blocking the right shoulder, and traffic sitting idle in San Francisco, northbound 280 from Mariposa to King. Steve Herrera for KQED.
Traffic support comes from Shen Yun Performing Arts. Support for KQED comes from PG&E, encouraging listeners to be prepared for emergencies by practicing opening their garage door manually and considering backup power options. More at safetyactionscenter.pge.com. I'm Michelle.